I'm gonna sound really echoey today, I think, because of this room.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, you got your mic. You'll probably be okay, but.
Yeah, hopefully.
All right.
Hello and welcome to the Great Movies Podcast, a retrospective film review show where we watch and discuss the movies covered in Roger Ebert's seminal film essay collection, The Great Movies. I'm Dylan Quayer.
And I'm Jana Gardner.
And Nick has abandoned us today.
Nick free episode.
He thought work would be more important than podcasting.
Yeah.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, yeah. I gotta go, you know, help people,
But, so we're doing a fill-in episode today, and
we're doing a Dylan birthday episode! Happy birthday, Dylan!
Thank you. It was my birthday 4 days ago now, but this is my birthday week, I guess, and...
It's Leo season.
It is Leo season, and I don't know how much my Leo season is in bloom right now. I've been pretty tired.
Yeah, it's all right. It's just warming up. You're just getting started.
But I basically got to pick the movie free of charge this week, and I picked a couple of ideas. I tried to pick all summer movies, for sure. So one was End of Summer by Ozu, but we've done a lot of Ozus recently for fill-in episodes. I thought about doing Scattered Clouds by Naruse, but Jana didn't want anything too depressing this week. And that movie is one of the most depressing things I've ever seen.
I read the one-sentence description, and I was like, maybe we don't.
Yeah, maybe we don't. It's
this movie
it's
that
fair.
Seems to be about grief and loss and other things.
And I went with an Archer's movie that doesn't show up in an Ebert book, and it's called Canterbury Tale. It's probably my favorite Archer's movie outside of The Red Shoes, but they're all the best, so it's kind of hard to say.
Wow, this is your second favorite?
This is my second.
Interesting, okay.
Then Colonel Blimp, and then Edge of the World, and Matter of Life and Death, and so on and so forth from there, but... I've seen this now 4 times, and every time I watch it, I think I like it more and more. And one of the reasons I was really interested in this is one of the first books I fell in love with in school was The Canterbury Tales by Chaucer. And when I read that book, it felt like reading something that was completely new in a way of every single piece of prose was different between all the characters. There wasn't necessarily a straightforward narrative, but everything had a satisfying conclusion in the end. Some things were really crass, some things were very high-minded. Like, it was like this beautiful coming together of all these sort of ideas of people traveling through this world. And what I learned, Archer's made a movie called The Canterbury Tale. I got super excited until I realized it wasn't an adaptation of Chaucer's book. But I think a lot of those ideas stick to this movie as well, because... Before you saw this movie, I watched it with Kasia, and she was not into it for most of it. And the first time I watched it, I was a little, unbalanced maybe watching it. I didn't know how to watch this movie, and it's not a weird movie per se, but like I told you, it feels like having to learn a new film language while watching it. So I'm curious how... your reaction was, especially because you usually rate things on Letterboxd before we start the episode, so I have an idea of where we are going in, and you didn't. So I'm
coming in hot. I ended up watching this morning, so
okay.
That is why I have not rated it on Letterboxd yet.
Okay.
I will say, full disclosure, I have not read The Canterbury Tales.
Okay.
I have not seen the Pasolini film. The Canterbury
Neither have I need to see that at some
point. I've seen the film A Knight's Tale, so that's kind of my...
Well, we should do A Knight's Tale as a fill-in episode sometime.
We frickin' should. Oh, man. If we would have thought about
that in
advance.
What a fun movie that was.
What a fun movie. Love that movie. I've seen it 8 million times. Like, one of a early DVD buy that I just watched.
Hot take, but, like, maybe that's Heath Ledger's one of his best performances?
Yeah. I think so. Super charismatic. I mean, obviously, like, Paul Bettany in that movie, unbelievable.
God damn.
Yeah, just playing Chaucer, like, you know. Great, great. So I'm only slightly exaggerating when I say that pretty much my knowledge of Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales comes from the context of A Knight's Tale. That's only a little bit of hyperbole. So I will say about this, about A Canterbury Tale, I did appreciate you sort of, you gave me a heads up yesterday that you're like, it starts off a little slow. And then I think maybe I was prepared for it to be, which was good in some ways, because I think it overshot my expectations the other way. Because when I started, I'm like, this isn't that slow and weird. This is just kind of like a movie. It's like a hangout movie. Like, they're hanging out in this town. Okay, weird little low-stakes story. I mean, don't get me wrong. Some mystery person dumps glue in my hair. I'm taking it very seriously. But, like, but it feels like a weird for a, what I knew was like a wartime movie. Like, just sort of a weird little low-stakes movie where they just...
The most war is a tank ambush practice run on one of our main characters' horse and cart.
Right, which that little scene stuck out to me as something that I think they must have sped up, because the shot of the tank going like, and it like takes this corner really quickly, and I was like, I don't think that's how that works. But yeah, that's the most action that takes place, other than of course all the young boys in the town who are like doing their various war.
Oh my god, one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Well, and not to like get sidetracked immediately, but the guy has that line where he's like, I'm going to round up all the local gorillas. And I was like, what kind of like guerrilla warfare were there? Oh, and then it's like all the little boys and they're like boats, like play acting, being in the army. That was very cute. But so I think I was kind of in between. I wasn't, you know, you told me that Kasia was just like not feeling it basically until the end, pulled it together. Mm-hmm. I was like feeling it. I was just like, okay, I'm not sure like why this is so special. Like, this is just like, you know, it's a nice movie from the 40s about people in England, and it seems nice. It does look great.
Oh my god, it looks so good.
I was reading a little bit about like how their cinematographer, who came from like German expressionism, and you can really see that in a lot of the sort of,
especially in the
dynamic
first scenes.
Yes, like the early like dynamic low light scenes, and there's a lot of like
a lot of natural light.
Yes, a lot of really good uses of light. So it looked great. But otherwise, I was kind of just like, huh, I don't know, all right, cool little movie. Which is mostly still how I feel about it, but the ending, it has a very, very, very lovely ending that made me, like, super emotional. I mean, I'm an easy mark in that way, but, like, and I also should have known exactly how it was going to end, because I do understand.
It's so obvious once you get to it, but because the movie doesn't really have much of a narrative structure to it.
And even though they like refer to them as like pilgrims on the road
to Canterbury to either do penance or get a miracle, and
right.
that's exactly what happens in the end.
And you don't really think of, but like, yeah, they literally tell you that, but because it doesn't feel like that's what's happening, it still kind of catches you off guard with this payoff at the end when everybody gets their
miracles
or So yeah, it was very nice. I really had a good time with it.
Yeah, that's good. One of my favorite things about this movie, though, is they do say the date of my birthday in the movie.
Mm.
When they're going through some of the dates of glue buying. And
sure.
One of them is August 3rd. So
nice.
I was like,
I didn't notice that, but I will say I am also someone who notices, like, in a movie when they say my birthday, I will, like...
What is your birthday date
December?
Exactly? It's in December.
December 20th.
To 20th, okay.
So, frankly, even if there's a movie where there's like counting down to Christmas and there'll be like 5 days till Christmas, I'll be like,
you're
hey guys, I count that counts as someone saying my birthday in a movie.
Sure.
That's usually how it comes up more often than someone saying the actual date. Is just a lot of movies have a structure where they count down to Christmas, mm-hmm. and so whenever it's 5 days till, I'm like, birthday. so yeah, that's I can relate to that. I did enjoy in the sequence you were just sort of referencing, like, their little sort of gumshoe detective work they do when they actually start
good.
Putting together like dates and alibis and receipts and all that.
The interesting thing about this movie, and something that confused me the first time watching this, is it sets up a whodunit, but it never gives an alternate case to Culpepper the whole movie. From the first part, you're like, so that's like the obvious answer. So what is the real answer? And then most of the time, it's just like, Well, we know it's Culpepper. We just need to, like, figure out how it's Culpepper.
Right. So Matt looked up the plot of the movie while we were watching it this morning. And I can't remember why he looked. He just was like, he was confused by something, so he looked it up. And he's like, well, he's like, I guess I spoiled for myself who the glue man is, except for there's only one person who it could be. So I don't know. I guess that's not really spoiling anything. Like, yeah.
Again, that was like one of the things where it's like watching it the first time, I didn't really fully understand. But when you have to get out of this movie, it's not about necessarily the mystery or the narrative. It's really specifically about we have to ingrain ourselves in this town, which has just this really deep historical meaning to multiple people. And understand why it's so important that we are travelers in this land and what it, especially during a time of war like this. Like, it is just about the worst time.
Right. And it's about more like, it's not a whodunit in that we're like looking at all these different suspects and everything. But yeah, it's about these people sort of coming together in this place, in this time to sort of, tackle this, like, little issue in this town.
Yeah.
And how meaningful that is, yeah.
So, one of the first things I want to start off with this movie is the three non-Culpepper leads.
Mm-hmm.
All three, this was like their first movie.
Yeah.
Gibbs was played by... who is Gibbs played by?
His name is Dennis Price.
Dennis Price. So he probably had the most successful career of the three, which I think is interesting because I think he's the least interesting in the movie. But I think that might just be his character.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he very classically trained. He's also got the main part in Kind Hearts and Coronets, which is another very popular movie from the 40s. And then there's Sheila Slim, who is taught in the Royal Academic Drama Associates. It's called RADA.
Mm-hmm. The Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, I believe.
Dramatic Arts, okay. She didn't act too much after this, but did you see who she married?
I sure did, yeah. She married Sir Richard Attenborough.
Her Wikipedia page, it's the Right Honorable the Lady Attenborough. It's not Sheila Slim.
Yep, Barris Attenborough. So she acted less after that. They were together. They were married in 1945 until his death in 2014, and then she died 2 years later. So they had a long, long marriage. That's nice for them.
Yeah. And lastly, and this is the most interesting point in the movie, John Sweet.
Yeah.
Who plays Bob Johnson.
Right. The American U.S. Army sergeant playing an American U.S. Army sergeant.
Who had no formal actor training whatsoever.
And didn't really act again.
He never acted. He only has one other credit on Letterboxd, which is an interview about A Canterbury Tale.
Right.
One of my favorite stories about him, though, is he took his $2,000 he made with Canterbury Tale and he donated all of it to the NAACP.
Right. Just a wild thing.
Which is insane in the 1940s.
Yeah.
What a cake.
Especially someone who probably could have used $2,000. Like, that's a lot of money. Yeah. I have questions that I wish I'd had time to look into more. Like, a quick Google didn't get me there. I bet if I went and tracked down that interview he gave, it would address it. But, like, how he was able to make this movie. Like, sort of what was the arrangement? Like, was he just on leave from the army and spent that time?
I believe so, and I believe he was stationed in England.
It looks like he was stationed there, and he just had enough time off while being stationed in England to just film a whole movie, which is pretty crazy. He's so good.
Okay, good. I'm glad you liked him, because it's really a performance like no other, and I don't necessarily mean that in a good nor a bad way.
It's very mannered. Well, I don't know if it's mannered, because I don't know if it's just like that's how he is, but it's very affected. It's very, like...
Affected is probably the best word for it.
But it's not, like... I don't think he's that far off from, like, a Jimmy Stewart, like, quality, right? I mean, that's kind of was the style of the time, and so I think, like, and I love Jimmy Stewart, so I think that's kind of why I was on this level.
I do think there was a really good point to casting a complete completely untrained actor in his part. Because, well, did you see they looked at Burgess Meredith for the part? And
yeah, that
instead of casting him as the actor, he just became Sweet's script supervisor. That's adorable.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like that kind of would take you out of it a little bit. Or it would, now, like watching it now, that would be so weird if just Burgess Meredith was in this movie with these other people who are less recognizable to me anyway.
Yeah. But when we come back to this movie, like, a lot of it is about understanding how people communicate with each other. A lot of it is about the language differences between class, between nationalities, between, you know, cities versus country, jobs. And I think it's so important that this guy just speaks completely differently from any of the other actors that, like, it is noticeable the way he's on a different language barrier than anyone else, when even in terms of the Brechtian idea of the movie, I guess. But yeah, so I'm glad you like John Sweet.
Definitely.
Because I showed it to Alex, I don't think Alex liked him that much. It was just very, I don't know.
Yeah, I can see how it's, you probably are either charmed by him or a little bit put off. And so I can see that sort of like falling on either side.
How did Matt feel about the movie?
He enjoyed it.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah, he had to leave before it was over, so I had to text him the ending.
Oh my god, that's the best part! What the
fuck? I know, he had to go to work. And so, I know, I was like, you missed the... I was like, I called him, or I texted him, and then I called him, and I was like, you missed all the good parts at the end. but no, he was enjoying it while we were watching it. Yeah, kind of similar. It was just like, okay, so it's just, yeah, kind of a... Like it feels like a low stakes hangout movie. It's so funny that it's like, and then it's more profound when you get to the end, obviously. But you're just sort of watching these people making the best of their situation, and like there's kind of a read of it of like where the problems of the war and everything are just sort of so immense that all you can really do is just like
100%,
right? Just like here's a problem we can solve. We're in this town. We can figure out this blue man situation. We can make our way to Canterbury. And you know, you put all of your efforts and focus into, tackling the things you can solve, because you can't really solve thinking that your you know, fiance boyfriend has died, or that your, you know, girlfriend isn't writing you letters. Like, there's all these things that are beyond your control. So, you know, you can try to take down that glue man. Every time they say glue man, it's funny.
It's very funny. Yeah, so we can jump into the movie from here then.
Yeah.
I did want to say though that you were talking about how this movie is very much about like we sometimes need to like just completely disconnect from this war to try to understand our lives better and the point of life itself more. So the Archers did a lot of sort of propaganda British Army films. Some of them more successful as far as propagandists go, but quite often they got into a lot of trouble with the British government that was funding their movies because it wasn't propagandist enough. And this feels like a movie that would be like this would be they have some sort of propagandist things, like the kids play fighting, and it's like, look at the next generation coming up to protect. But even that is just so silly. It's just kind of cute. The big one is the life and death of Colonel Blimp, which they completely over, because that one has a very sympathetic German character in it, and they were not happy about that. Even though a lot of it is about like, and he's like not a Nazi. He's like someone that was argued against this British guy who is named Candy, but is basically Colonel Blimp. Mm-hmm. Colonel Blimp was a cartoon, if you didn't know that.
Yeah, I think I did know that.
Yeah, so they kind of knew each other and knew each other throughout all these like wars and times, and then they get to World War II, and then they're like, oh, fuck. But it's just the fact that it's a nice German was a problem for them, and especially the way they tackled the way they needed to fight in the movie. And there was this big story that when they were getting funding from the movie, like Churchill finally caved and was like, fine, you get the money, But if you do make this movie the way you want to make it and not the way we want to make it, you don't get the knighthood.
Oh, interesting. Like,
And their response is basically, cool, fuck you. And then they went the movie. I think that kind of carried over into this movie and The Small Back Room and a couple of their other films.
Well, and I think there's, and at least I have an easier time with films that are kind of like wartime propaganda films when they're a little bit more about like the home front and the home effort and stuff, you know, where you're not really like looking at like generals in the, you know, decision making and like leading battles. It's
the glorification of let's go get to murder some people.
Exactly. It's absolutely still wartime propaganda. But when they're the more like we've got to be brave on the home front and we've got to, you know, the women are going to join the women's land auxiliary or, you know, and go.
God, I love the farm that.
Yeah, the land.
Sheila Slim
the land
on.
Girls. Yeah, like that. You know, women are going to be farmers and work the land, and you know, it's just, that's easier. It's just an easier sit often than the type that's like, let's go drop these bombs, and you're like, oh, okay. Even though it's all to the same end, it's all about getting people on board with the war. But you know, that's how that goes.
Yeah. So we open the movie with this narration from a Chaucer book, which I just wrote as so English.
It is incredibly English.
It is offensively English, probably.
Yeah, it is.
But this sort of takes us into this quote-unquote flashback where we basically are watching the actual Canterbury Tale pilgrims on their road to Canterbury through Kent. And we have this match cut transition from these people riding horseback in an illustration into them riding horseback, and then an even more brilliant match cut, and was one of another inspiration for one of the most famous edits of all time, which is Kubrick's Bone Throw.
Sure.
Because it's one of these things where it's like this thing that's old cuts to this thing that is new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the history to modernity kind of thing.
Yeah, so instead of a bone to a spaceship, this one, someone lets a falcon go, and it flies up in the air and it turns into a plane, basically.
Yeah.
It's so good.
That's pretty cool.
And then they're reading this sort of section out of Chaucer, and then they try to do Chaucer again, but written for modern times, and it doesn't sound as good as Chaucer, but that's okay.
Yeah.
So basically, the concept of this movie starts off in the first scene. We arrive on a train in Chillingbourne, a fictional town in the province of Kent. Is it province? What do they call there?
I don't know. That sounds good to me.
The region of Kent?
County of Kent? I don't know. I have no idea.
Sorry.
UK district. People. Yeah, sorry. We're offensively American over here, so.
So they get off in Chillingbourne in Kent. The train person calls out, next stop, Canterbury, and John Sweet jumps off the train because he says, this stop, Canterbury.
I will say also, that has confused me on trains sometimes. Like,
oh, of course.
When you're stopped at a station and it says, like, you know, next stop, and you sort of think, like, wait, this stop? Like, do I get out? Yeah, so I understand the confusion. And then you're like, oh, no, I have to wait for the next one. But he hopped off the train too quickly.
Yeah. But I think this already starts the thing of the language of life of English people versus American people. Mm-hmm. And it already goes back to then the train conductor is like, hey, your stripes are the wrong way around, which is a continuing joke throughout the movie.
Yeah.
But basically, he and Peter Gibbs and Allison Smith all get off at the train here. And they're supposed to walk Allison Smith into town, which Costi pointed out. Leaving a girl with two guys is maybe more dangerous in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But
I guess they're trustworthy folks, but yeah, that's
yeah. And as they're walking, someone jumps out of the shadows and dumps glue on her hair. Oh no!
Yeah, that would be very upsetting if that happened to me.
Yeah. They chase the glue man through the streets and determine he has somehow gotten into this building, which is sort of like the town hall. Mm-hmm. They sort of wash her hair out and go upstairs to where they suspect the glue man is, and all that is there is what's his first name? Thomas Culpepper, played by Eric Portman, who was previously in an Archer movie called The 49th Parallel. He wasn't one of the main characters, but he's there.
Okay.
Oh, he's also in another one called One of Our Aircraft is Missing. That's one of the more like let's go
What
fight
a
for Britain.
well, I'm seeing that that's from 1942, so that tracks. But what a title for a movie. One of Our Aircraft is Missing. Okay, I have an idea what that might be about.
Guess what it's about?
An aircraft goes missing? What if it wasn't? What if you're like, twist, it's about something else entirely.
Yeah.
Yeah, this looks like
The
this is gonna
interesting thing
be.
is, it seems more about the Dutch fighters than the English fighters.
Well, I think what happens is they the based on this Wikipedia page I just clicked on, the Royal Air Force pilots have to eject over the net, so they land in the Netherlands, and so
Oh.
it's like yeah, some British airmen who end up hanging out with a bunch of Dutch people apparently, but one o only six out of seven or f oh, five out of six find each other. One of their aircraft is missing.
Gotcha, gotcha.
Yeah.
Interesting. That sounds good. I'm gonna watch that now.
And I'm guessing it ends up okay because it is a propaganda movie, so I'm guessing the soldiers prevail. Like, I don't think
I'm
it's gonna
sure
be
they
a,
do.
yeah.
So they basically they're cleaning out Allison's hair. They go upstairs and they find Culpepper and.
Like we said, it is kind of funny that they're like, well, I guess the glue man's not here. There's just this one guy.
Yeah,
Yeah.
but I think they bring up a really good point because like right after this, they go to a hotel. Well, they talk with Culpepper for a little bit, and he has
Yeah.
this ingrained wooden thing on the top of his stairs that says "Love and honor the truth," which that feels like a
Yeah.
what a look you just gave me.
I'm just saying, this guy's not exactly about the truth.
So, he goes to they go to a hotel and there's a bartender that's talking with Allison and she's from London. And there's this great point, and I think it comes back to why they wouldn't suspect Culpepper. He's like, "Well, I know Thomas Culpepper. Everyone knows Thomas Culpepper. Everyone in the city knows Thomas Culpepper. Don't you
Exactly.
know the mayor of London?" She's like, "Eh, not really."
Yeah,
And
you're like, oh,
he's
London's a
like,
little different than
"Well,
this place.
yeah." And so again, like now instead of English versus American language, now it's like city versus country language that.
Right. Which, yeah, recurs throughout, sort of, especially like
Yes.
later on, it gets more into the city versus the country.
Yeah. They stay in a place called the Hand of God, which feels, I don't know, I love all the titles and symbols in this
Yeah.
movie because like there's the logo is a little hand reaching across like a to shake someone's hand. And the bedroom that John Sweet stays in, it's like a very narrow road in between his building and the other building. They say that 2 6-foot men could reach across and shake each other's hands, and it's like, oh, here it comes back to sort of this unity, togetherness. But then I love that it goes back and it says that 2 6-foot men couldn't reach across the bed and shake each other's hands.
Do you know what, you remember what the woman says? So what that exchange is he's like, it was really lonely sleeping in that, big bed. It's so big that 2 6-foot men couldn't reach across and shake each other's hands. And he goes, why would they want to do that? And the woman goes, depends on who's in it. It's like, ma'am,
Well, this is around
that
the
is a
time
wrong trajectory.
that Kasia explicitly told me, "Dylan, this is a very gay movie."
I was gonna, yeah, like Matt and I both sort of like did a double take at that. We're like, that was kind of a raunchy joke for that landlady to be making, but all right. Yeah, there's some like, I mean, I don't think any of it's ever well at this era like intentional, but it is just funny now, sort of like, all the military dudes just hanging out together and like references all the stuff that comes across very homoerotic in a modern context.
Yeah. Going back to English versus American, this is also a point where Bob tries to get some coffee, and everyone looks at him with such scorn and disdain that, A lot of
coffee versus tea.
Yes.
Oh my God! Sorry, not to jump all the way ahead at the end, but there's a line at the end about how he'd like rather have marijuana than tea was also a very surprise.
That was like, oh my God, let's go 1940s. Wow. Archers.
Okay. Yeah, it's very all right. Yeah, he gets into a lot of hijinks as an American out of his element for sure.
I can really see John Sweet smoking a joint in the Oregon woods.
Yeah, all right, that makes sense. Yeah.
So now this is sort of when Allison's like, "Yo, Bob, you mind not catching the 8:57 train to go to Canterbury where you expected? Because we want to solve the Glue Man mystery." And she's like, "Yeah, sure." Mm-hmm. We learn that Allison's fiance was a geologist, which again feels important. He's like a studier of natural history, and mm-hmm. a lot of this movie is just sort of about the natural history that we occupy. You saw Memoria, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of reminds me of like the Memoria thing of like, what are we living on? What is the history of where we are and stuff? Yeah. In two very different styles, though. Like, I don't think you can find two movies that are completely different from each other. This movie sort of has this wonderful little fantastical feel to it, and one of my favorite parts of it is when Bob wakes up and there's just sort of a kid floating outside his window.
Oh my God, yeah. He has also a great exchange with that kid, another American versus British, like,
yeah.
chat.
It's a quarter, that's a shilling.
Yeah.
But he's not actually floating. He's standing on a cart of hay that is a literal story tall. It's hilarious how much hay they have in that cart. How did they get all that hay in there? I don't know, but it's enough for a kid to stand on it and look into a second floor man's bedroom window.
Yep.
This is one of my favorite sort of language barriers, because Allison and Bob go to these woodworkers who are sort of fixing her cart, and these are two people that maybe Allison should have more in common with than Bob. But instead, after Allison is talking and trying to figure out like what exactly she needs, what are they trying to tell her about, what is wrong with the cart, what kind of wood to use, Bob steps in and is like, "Oh, I literally know everything, because even though we live on completely different parts of the world, wood is wood, and we both farm wood the same way and chop the wood down at the certain times." And
he talks a lot about cedar.
Yes,
he's got a lot of thoughts about cedar in particular. Very Pacific Northwest vibe.
Sure. Actually, so what he meant, one of the cedars he mentions is the cedars of the god was the cradle he was born in. Do you know about that tree?
No.
So it's one of the famous biblical trees, and it's this famous tree in Lebanon. And Cassia lived in Lebanon for a while.
Oh, cool.
And this is a very endangered sort of tree species. Mm-hmm. And she went to visit it, and there were like four trees. And she was like, "What in the..." So she was when Bob said he was born in a Cedars of the God crib, she was like, "No, he wasn't."
Yeah, like, but okay. it works for the, you know,
the narrative.
Yeah. Also, that scene is just very
cute.
It's also like very equivalent modern scene of like woman at a mechanic shop who the guys are like talking a bunch of nonsense to, and it takes another guy coming in being like, "Actually, this is how, like, I know what you're talking about. This is what we're
I think it would feel more that way if it wasn't for this idea of like there was these two people that lived in the same way in two different parts of the world, and there's this interesting connection there. But it does feel a little bit like, "I need to mansplain to you what's wrong with your cart."
I think 100% what was intended was
the
reading of it. But from a modern context, it does feel a little bit like, "Let's let the men talk about the cart." I'm like, okay.
So this is also where we sort of learn about the two backstories of Allison and Bob. She had a fiance who was a geologist and then became a fighter pilot when the war started. Mm-hmm. His plane was shot down and he died.
Yeah. Really, really like...
More to come.
Bob probably could have handled that entire interaction a little bit better when it was like, "Well, I hope your man writes to you." Well, no, he doesn't. And like, instead of just like being like, oh, she seems sad, maybe don't prod at this. Well, why isn't, you know, oh, you know, a good man should be writing to you. And it's like, oh, he died. He doesn't write to me because his plane was shot down. Like,
I'm sure this has happened to many people, Bob. You should not be like so shocked that this is happening.
You're in the war. You can't take it for granted that he's fine. But yeah, I mean, he feels bad. It's just funny that it's like a little bit more tact when she didn't want to talk about it.
So let's see.
And then his backstory is with his girl.
Stopped writing to him.
Yeah, stopped writing to him. Didn't get any letters from her. He was sad.
Yeah. I like the quote he says where they would walk in the wood for 2 hours without saying anything and then say the same thing at the same time. It was cute.
Mm-hmm.
So Allison's job in the mystery is basically to go to all the women that got glued and sort of figure out when they got glued, what happened when they got glued, yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
And when she's kind of going through this, she sort of makes her way to working on a woman's farm because she was supposed to go work for Culpepper on his farm.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, no women because he's a misogynist.
Yeah.
Which
it's almost like maybe he wants to find a way to keep women in their homes and not being out and about places.
Which comes back to like a great final joke in the train later. But mm-hmm. So at this point, it's like, no. Sort of sets up this Culpepper mentality.
Mm-hmm.
But she goes to work on a woman's farm and she's interviewing a few of the women that got glued there.
Every time you say got glued, it's still... I mean, again, appreciate the fact that they keep it... It's not like women being like violently assaulted, you know? Like this movie would be a very different vibe if it was like all these women were being like...
This was a darker movie, you could just replace glued with raped.
Groped or just something where it's like they're all being traumatized. This is just like they were significantly inconvenienced, and that was a very rude thing for somebody to do.
I love that that's the highest stake in this movie. I love this movie
so
much.
They got glue in their hair. Yeah, they really had to go shampoo their hair a lot to get that glue.
Not shampoo, hot water.
Yes, you're right. Only hot water. They just shampoo their hair.
Yeah.
Melt the glue.
So, I wrote down this quote. I don't remember where it's from, but it said, "What makes a civilian a soldier in uniform?" I thought that was an interesting.
Yeah.
Do you remember what part that's in?
I remember the quote. It's like something about there's a line before it. This is great because I can't quite remember the context either. But there was a line before it that says something about like, you know, civilians are one way and soldiers are another way, and what makes a civilian a soldier a uniform? And it was just something that Bob. I'm pretty sure it was Bob said. Just trying to be like, we're not really that different. Like, you know, you put a uniform on and you're a soldier. We're not actually like a different type of person.
We're still just civilians.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is also when Allison gets her horse-drawn carriage ambushed by the tanks. She is very mad at them, but it turns out to just be Peter.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of are talking about the glue man. He says he has some more information because one of the people was going to go out with a girl in his regiment, and then his date got glued. Oh no.
Yeah.
That's kind of just where we're at this point, but then we sort of get, I guess this is the end of the first act, because then around halfway we get to this point where Culpepper puts on like the seminar that everyone's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
See all these souls because it's like the one thing happening in town.
Mm-hmm.
And his lecture's sort of about the history of England, of the land, of Canterbury. And this has probably my favorite exchange of two people not understanding each other's language that are speaking English, which is Bob talking to one of the British officers with this gigantic mustache.
Oh. That guy has the best look in the entire movie.
Oh my god!
That guy's entire that was Matt's main takeaway. Is like I had like looked down for a second, and Matt was like, "Look at this guy! Look at this guy!" And I looked up, and it's just like this guy with like his mustache, and he's just like, being very British, and yeah.
And he inquires to Bob after learning he's American. Do you know my friend Isaac Wells in Butt City, Montana? And I guess in England, where things are pretty small and each town has its own sort of sequestered neighborhood, it's like if you meet this town people, you kind of meet everyone in that town, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Because I think that, like, England is the size of New Mexico.
Yeah.
And so it is small. Mm-hmm. And because he just has this mentality of like, oh, you could just know people in your country.
Yeah.
He's asking about someone in Butte City, Montana. And Bob just looks at him and is like, the fuck are you talking about? But at this point, Bob understands that there's enough language differences between English and Americans. He's just like, tall, and he's like, he's a tall guy, isn't he? He's like, short and fat.
Well, even my dad has a story about when he was in, I can't remember, it was when he was in basic training or officer candidate school, but my dad was in Vietnam, and he has a story about, you know, meeting guys from all over the country and meeting a guy who was from like a small town. I can't remember if it was in the like east or in the south, but said to my dad, like, oh, you're from California? Do you know my friend? He's in California.
And you're just like, no.
No, California, pretty large state, actually. I don't know your friend in California. Like,
sorry.
Yeah. And so it's like, even within the states, regionally, it's people are like, I don't know, I'm in Rhode Island. We all know each other. Like, everyone in California knows each other? Oh, no, a little different. Little different.
Yeah, true. I just love Bob's reaction, though, of like, he at first is like, what? And then he's like, oh. It's a British thing.
That's a lot.
And tries
of his
to play
reactions.
Along a little bit.
Yeah, that's a lot of his reactions, where he just sort of takes a beat and is like, "Okay, I'll just go with it."
But then I love that they both grew up on streets with the names with a number of sisters in it. It's like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Again, we both have these weird connections, but these completely different languages and ideas, and we're all sort of coming together right now.
Mm-hmm.
God, I love this movie. So this is sort of when he talks about Canterbury. They come to ask for blessings or penance, which is super important by the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lecture really to connect to the past. There's this beautiful moment of lighting, and this comes back to the German Expressionism.
Mm-hmm.
He, Culpepper's in complete silhouette while he's talking, and because there's this, what is it called? Projector that's onto him.
And he had them close, like, all the, you know, curtain. Like, there's a thing where he's like, you know, help with the blackout, and they all, like, pull the curtain shut so that it's in this stark projector light. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, all these soldiers are just sort of there because there's nothing to do. But there's this brilliant moment where he sort of leans in, and then suddenly his eyes start to glow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. It cuts to Allison, and she closes her eyes, and her eyes darken.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, she's the only one really connecting to Culpepper here. This idea of, like, what does history mean? What does the land mean?
Right.
Oh, gives me chills every time I see it.
Yeah. That whole scene was really striking.
Yeah. And then, even better, this is the best part, is he's talking with Allison about a caravan of geologists that used to be on the hill. Between Chillingbourne and Canterbury. And he was like, they found these really ancient coins. I was looking for them. I inquired about them in a British museum, yada, yada, yada. And she just goes, I have those coins. I just love this sense of connection that all these people have to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you watch it again, like, those are the moments that, like, provide a narrative thrust as far as there can be one.
Right.
Of just humans connecting to humans rather than, you know, this leads into this, leads into that.
Right.
I forgot to mention at the very beginning, and it comes up again here, but when it turns into nighttime, everyone's supposed to take out their torch.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of taking out, like, a little light, because they're in a blackout because of they're being bombed and they don't want to shine too much light. And Bob will always whip out a flashlight that is, like, I don't know, could look into, like, the night sky.
Yeah, so, like, right, I think like, it was military grade or something. Yeah.
Shut that light off.
We had a family friend who lived out, like, out in the boonies, middle of nowhere, sort of hills in Northern California. I swear he had one of those flashlights, like, because we'd go out there and we'd do, like, stargazing and stuff. And I swear I would, like, shine the flashlight and it looked
I've seen those flashlights,
yeah. You've seen those, right? And, like, it's the only one of those I've ever seen, and it, like, I was like, that felt like magic when I was a kid. I was like, you can
have
a light so bright that it literally, he can, like, use it to point it, like, where stars are. It's crazy.
It's
but yeah, not good if you're trying to hide from airplanes to not get bombed to have a flashlight.
No.
That's counterproductive.
So this is when, the next morning is when the kids play war.
Mm-hmm.
obviously Commander Todd's is the best, who's like a little kid who's just crying the whole time.
Yeah. Well, and I like it. There's a part where Bob like recruits the kids to help them out.
After their little kid battle, he's like,
right.
And by basically, I need the generals on both teams.
And he basically is like, if it, kids in America, I wouldn't even have to ask. Like, they would be doing their part or something like that, where he's, like, trying to guilt the British kids. Like, you know, American kids, they
he's guilting so much, because then he gets to this point where one of the kids asks what an isolationist, and he's like, the isolationists are bad, you motherfuckers.
Yeah. Oh, you don't want to help, the isolationists will hear you. That's how they win. These kids have no idea what he's talking about.
Oh, it's so funny.
Yeah, very funny.
So this is, again, drugstore versus grocer is another point of language barriers.
And how many of them are there? Is there only one in the town?
Yeah. And it just happens to so be the kid's father.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this is where they're sort of going through records and of who bought what. And they come to realize that this is probably an upper-class person instead of a local soldier.
Uh-huh.
And he could be buying it wholesale from outside of the county. And instead of looking at receipts, they have to look at salvage. And there's this great point when they realize that Bob just goes, salvage! And it's sort of this like dissolve after it. It's like, this such a weird
it was, that transition. Was a really strange moment, yes.
Salvage!
Okay.
Yeah. So they start going through the salvage, and then comes the part where Gibbs goes and visits Culpepper, because they're pretty sure it's Culpepper.
They're really narrowing in on the only suspect that they've ever had.
That's like Culpepper or another suspect to be named later.
Right, yeah. It's either Culpepper.
The to be named later is just...
Or
something. Oh, it is Culpepper.
Uh-huh, yeah.
There's so many good quotes in the scene, and I wrote a few of them down. So one of them is Culpepper to Gibbs, and he says, every second man thinks of himself as a missionary, and every third man has a bee in his bonnet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, when are you actively trying to help and teach others, and when are you like old man yells at clouds sort of thing?
Right. Yeah,
and Culpepper is like really right in this line between being a missionary and literally having a bee in his bonnet and spilling glue in people's hair.
Yep, pretty much.
We learn that Gibbs is a church organist,
mm-hmm.
who well, is always one.
He's a cinema organist.
He trained to be a church organist. He trained mm-hmm. at like some royal academy.
Yeah,
and the only place that would hire him was a movie organist. And,
which. How thriving was that by the 40s? Do we still have a lot of cinema organists? I feel like that is a dying...
I don't know.
Right? I mean, I genuinely don't know. I just know that we're easily 15 years into the sound era here.
And yeah.
I'm not sure how much longer cinema organist is going to be a thriving occupation.
Good news for you, Peter Gibbs. I do not think you'll be a movie organist much longer.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a good quote where Culpepper says, a man who learns to play Bach, who will... There's two men in this world. One is a man who learns to play Bach, only to play I Kiss Your Hand in a movie theater, mm-hmm. and a man who walks step by step, only to end up on the top of Mount Everest.
Mm-hmm.
So very much of like, don't worry too much about the big picture things. Just sort of mm-hmm. take things as they are, one by one. And yeah. you'll find whatever your Everest is at some point.
Not to drag the level of discourse down, but if Cassia thought that there were like gay undertones in this movie, did she like the part in this scene where they talk about the only time he'd ever like had his hands on a big organ was in the academy?
I didn't even think of that.
That's a thing that happened in that scene too. That I was like, yeah, but that was just something I was like. Oh. Yeah, that's funny.
The one note Cassia had in the scene, which is he finds out that Culpepper works for the fire guard and the fire watch or the home guard on mm-hmm. a few days of the week. And before they couldn't figure out what the connection was between all the glue men days. And mm-hmm. immediately he's like, oh, it's the days he's on home guard and fire watch.
Right.
And there's this big rota paper, which I guess is like, according to Cassia, do you know what a rota is? Okay, so there's this big thing on his wall that said Rhoda, and Cassia, who lived in Scotland for a bit, had to explain to me, again, the language barrier there. So Rhoda is a rotation schedule. So it would be marked down, when is your rotations coming up?
Right, so you're on and Tuesday night or whatever,
Yeah, so he takes the Rhoda, like Peter Gibbs literally steals Culpepper's Rhoda. And Cassia was like, well, now they know it's you. Now Culpepper's going to know you're on him, because what is he going to do? He's going to look at me like, where the fuck's my Rhoda? Who is here? Oh, it was Gibbs.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But, yes.
Then,
I would say, but it is important that he talks about his aspirations to, you know, be a sophisticated organist playing the beautiful large organs at a church, you know, playing the great music, and, you know, he's down at the cinema just plunking out some tunes.
Yeah. So now this is not really important to the story, but I did like Bob trying to understand how to operate a telephone in England, and John Sweet's acting of what we've talked about in the past, like someone's on the phone in old movies and they don't really take a pause between sentences to let someone answer, and it's always like, well, that's fake. And John Sweet isn't even taking a single breath. He's just like, so how many rooms do you have? None? Oh, well, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I'm just like, John, my boy. Yeah. And now we get to probably my favorite scene before the ending in the movie, which is when Allison takes a walk up the hill and sees Canterbury in the distance, and suddenly Culpepper appears out of the grass.
Yeah.
But just before he does, she was starting to hear like bells and laughter and stuff, and almost got transported back in time to hear the pilgrims on their own journey to Canterbury. And she just sort of lays down with Culpepper in the grass. They just sort of lay next to each other and just watch the clouds. Mm-hmm. And I love this sort of break we get in this scene.
Yeah, nice quiet moment.
Yeah. And then it gets interrupted by Bob and Gibbs just very loudly talking about everything in their lives to each other, walking up the hill.
Mm-hmm.
What the size of a river is versus a creek.
Mm-hmm.
Another good American versus English thing.
Yep.
They do reveal that they are on to the glue man, that they know it's Culpepper.
Mm-hmm.
At which point Culpepper kind of storms off.
Yeah.
They do throw out the nickname Glue Pepper, which is one of my favorite things in the movie.
That's good. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, it's pretty good.
So anyway, now that they realize it's Culpepper, they have all the evidence. Bob can get on to Canterbury. Allison can get on to Canterbury. Both Bob is going to meet a friend. Allison is going to get her caravan, which was her fiance's before the war and left it there.
Yeah.
And Peter's going for some unspecified reason, but we kind of learn around this point it's because they're about to go fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they decide when they get to Canterbury that they're going to go to the local magistrate and be like, or the local constable and be like, yo, that magistrate of yours?
Yeah.
He's dumping glue on people's hair. He's the glue man.
Glue Pepper himself.
But while they're in the train, Culpepper jumps on and jumps into their little train car.
That scene's amazing when they see him coming for the train. And
they're like, oh, fuck.
Well, she's like, oh, at least he didn't get, you know, at least he didn't come to our compartment. And then, of course, he walks into their compartment.
Yeah. This is sort of when he explains his point of why he was a glue man. Nice thing I've ever said. But it's... He kept on wanting people to come to his lectures before the war, and realized that when the war happened, this is a great opportunity that all these men were here with nothing really to do. They were just stationed like, oh, now people can come see my lectures.
They have nothing better to do than listen to me, like, prattle on about this town. Yeah.
Yeah. And the only problem is the girls. So what he needs to do is scare the girls away from the men by dumping glue in their hairs.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really roundabout, silly way of doing it.
Don't like the women being out and about in town, so yeah.
Gonna glue them. What else would you do?
Gotta glue them.
And I mean, Allison states the obvious, but why don't you just ask girls to come to the lectures? And I think throughout this movie, Culpepper has started to realize Allison is probably his closest human connection to what he lives for. And I think at this point, he just kind of looking at her and he's like, yeah, maybe I will.
You're right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
They do it. They make a great metaphor, though, that he killed the fly on the baby's head with a sledgehammer. Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly how they phrase that, but, you know, he killed the fly, but he also...
Right, you had a
kill the baby.
You had an issue you wanted to address, and you went about it in the most insane way possible.
Yeah, and then he's like, "You're going to turn me in, right?" And they're all like, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, there are higher courts than the magistrates to answer to," and like, there's this like cut to like, of Canterbury Cathedral in the background, and this is when we get really into like the fantastical god sort of things of the movie.
Yeah, this final section in Canterbury, like there's like extended sequences of just like soaring music with like shots of the cathedral in the town, and it's really something.
It's gorgeous.
It is.
I love the part where he says, I can't remember exactly what Culpepper says, but he says something like, "Maybe you won't turn the blue man in if you think more about." Mm-hmm. You know, his motives and his ideals, and Gibbs responds with, "I'll do that when I see a halo around my head," and then suddenly the light of the train arriving at the station comes in, and there's like a literal halo around his head.
Of course.
It's a pretty funny joke.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we follow Gibbs to the cathedral, and he sort of enters to the swell of music, and the first time I watched this, I was like, oh, well, this is the ending. And then there was 20 more minutes left in the movie.
Absolutely, exactly. No, it totally fooled me too with that, like the big swell of music, and I'm like, oh, this is kind of an interesting place to just stop it here. And then, yeah, there's fully 20 minutes left.
But I really think it's sort of like a book, a novel in two books. Like one book is 4/5 of the novel, and then there's like a little epilogue. Mm-hmm. Everything was sort of wrapped up to this point.
Yes,
totally. And now everyone gets to receive their miracles. Peter stands at the base of the church because he's sort of looking for someone to report Culpepper to there, and he accidentally runs into this person, and he's carrying music up papers up this staircase, and one of the papers falls down. It's a sheet of music, and it lands right on Peter Gibbs's feet.
Yep.
It's...
None of these ending sequences are like very subtle, but they're not trying to be. So
no, it's also part of me is like, okay, that's kind of corny, and the other part of me is like, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
I mean, that's how they get you, right?
Yeah. So Bob's sort of no, not Bob. Gibbs sort of follows this guy up the stairs. I think to return his music, but then he realizes, oh, this is the organist. Mm-hmm. He sort of gets to talk with him, and he's like, hey, want to play?
Yeah. You want to check out this bad boy?
And he plays Bach, which is exactly what he was. Toccata and fugue. Mm-hmm. All-timer.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's everyone knows what that piece is. It's the scary Bach song.
Where would you power rank it in the Fantasia musicals numbers?
Ooh. I haven't thought about that in a long time. It's pretty high up there.
It's because that one is like that's the one that's pure music, where instead of a story going along, it's literally just colors and lines and
right, which I love, love, love.
It's
pretty
fucking cool.
Mm-hmm.
Can we do a Fantasia episode? That would be fun.
Yeah, we should find a reason to do that. I have not rewatched Fantasia. I don't even know when the last. It's probably been 20 years.
That was one of like the first movies I loved as a kid. Just like,
that's a good one.
Especially because I started playing the cello at like 6, and I was like, "Fuck, this is cool."
Parts of it, I remember like parts of it scaring me though. Like
oh my god, it's terrifying.
Yeah, I was gonna say it has a lot of scary.
Everyone goes to the Night on Bald Mountain with the devil, but the Rite of Spring.
Yeah, that's scary.
The Rite of Spring, where all the dinosaurs slowly die in like a asteroid holocaust.
Also is rough stuff, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Probably the most terrifying thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's sort of where Bob goes for his miracle. Allison goes to her caravan, and on her way there, she sort of passes building by building that is not there. It was completely bombed out. They're just complete skeletons of what this historical town used to be. She gets to her caravan, and Culpepper shows up as she's sort of looking through, and is like, it's become infested. It's very dusty. There's moths everywhere. And the guy that sort of owns the...
And her tires are gone.
Her tires are gone. That's another big part. Come on, army. Stop stealing people's tires.
Nope, that's what they did. They needed the rubber. They needed the tires. Off it went. Yeah.
Yeah. But the person that owns the garage that is keeping the caravan is like, Miss Smith, your husband, Mr. Joffrey, is still alive. And she's like, holy shit.
Yeah, well, because at first it's just like, oh no, they're looking for you. Like, there's message for you. Someone's been trying to, like, track you down. And then, yeah, it turns out it's because, guess what? He's in, where did they say he was?
I didn't write that down.
He was somewhere still far flung, but,
He's still alive. I love her reaction, which is just like, I need to get this caravan ready right now.
Exactly. Yeah, she sort of like takes a moment of like being overwhelmed, and then she's like, gotta go.
It's really cute.
Yeah, it is.
And we see Bob meet his friend. This is when they talk about wanting to smoke some weed, get real high.
His friend, like, is giving him a hard time because on their like 3 days leave, his friend just went and partied in London. Like, he's like, I've been up for like 3 days straight partying in London, nightlife, clubs.
And Bob's like, you know, you're walking on the Pilgrim's Road here.
Right, exactly. The guy's just like, I've been partying for 3 days straight. I don't know what's happening.
I love all the just like Bob chastising his friend, like, don't you know the old road?
I know.
It's cute. But this
friend,
is when...
Yeah, has news for him, too.
Yo, I got all of these letters for you.
They, like, all showed up at once the day after Bob left.
Of course.
Because it turns out the letters had been coming from farther away than he was expecting. Because
she's in the... What is it called? The WACS?
Women's Auxiliary Corps, I think.
Okay.
And she's off in Australia. And he's like, and the way he says it, like, you can tell he's so proud of her. Like, that she, you know, and he's like, she joined the WAC. Like, yeah. And so.
She's like, what a badass.
Yeah.
Gotta totally marry that girl.
Nice little moment. Yeah.
There's a part, so this is a weird thing, but there's these two, when they're going through the town, there's these two signs. One is like shoe store, grocery, like it's some like little local thing. Another thing is called Boots.
Boots.
Do you know what Boots is?
No, I do not.
So Boots is like a CVS.
Oh, okay.
So this was a moment of like, on one side of the street was Old Canterbury, and on the other side is basically what
Boots is. Boots is like the drugstore grocer of the.
Yeah, yeah. It's like what New England is going to become.
Gotcha.
And,
okay.
I only know that because Cassia had a friend that worked at Boots. And so when she pointed that out, I was like, fuck, the archers just miss.
Yeah.
And this is one of my favorite parts is all the soldiers start walking away, or walking down the road to go off to war.
Mm-hmm.
They're the modern day pilgrims.
Yeah.
And instead of like this old prose about pilgrims going into war, instead it's Bob's friend taking these grainy little... 8mm photographs of them.
Snapshots, yeah.
And that would now be like a historical relic of the time, is these old 8mm films of these soldiers marching.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like Chaucer's text of that time would now be considered like a historical moment of that time. It just feels like things repeat itself, watching people going down the old Pilgrim's Road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we get our actual like sort of
music swell. There's a little title card that says "Each life that touches ours for God," and film.
And then we get the archers like specially thanking all the good people of Canterbury and
everyone. So they probably had to deal with a lot of shit.
Yeah. So very nice. Nice.
It's a very nice movie.
Yeah, I'm very glad I watched it.
Are you going to check out more Archer movies?
I am. I definitely, it's always been on the long-term plan, so I definitely, I have the Red Shoes Criterion. I just haven't broken it out yet.
Which archers do you think most interest you? Is it Red Shoes?
Yeah, Red Shoes, for sure.
Okay.
For sure. So,
but Nick is the one always pushing A Matter of Life and Death.
Yeah, he loves that one.
Black Narcissus is good.
Yeah, that Black Narcissus is probably the one that interests me the most after Red Shoes also.
That's probably the most Janna one I think
yeah,
I would expect.
I'll get there.
Although that one is like basically a perfect movie, and then there's some like really atrocious brown face in it that's always like, whoa! Especially because so much of the movie is about like how terrible England is, and like this, they're sort of like not understanding the others and colonizers, yeah. But then there's still this brown face in it. It's like,
Yeah.
So I guess we don't have an Ebert quote for this movie.
No.
Right?
No, give it a thumbs up.
Did this movie win any awards?
I don't think so.
Not that I know of, and I'm not seeing any awards.
No.
Page on the Wikipedia. So must have been kind of buried.
Yeah.
But yeah, so now we can rate this out of thumbs up.
Oh, thumbs up for sure.
Woohoo. Out of 4?
I give it a solid 3.5 out of 4.
I'll go 4.
Yeah. Very enjoyable movie.
So, what did you watch this week?
Not much. You know, I had a bunch of friends in town. I was super busy. So, really.
Could watch movies with them.
Yeah, no, none of my friends want to watch movies. To be fair, my one friend would have, we just didn't have time. But, so I'll just shout out what I watched last night. I've watched a bunch of like garbage horror movies in the past couple weeks, but just garbage. But a good movie that I watched last night was Prey, the new
I cannot wait
Predator
to watch
movie
Prey.
That's on Hulu, which is like that. So it's by Dan Trachtenberg, who also made 10 Cloverfield Lane, which is like a real favorite
so
of mine.
Good.
That movie freaking rules.
I think that movie is more of a favorite of John Goodman though than Dan Trachtenberg, because John Goodman gave like
that,
how did he not get
amazing.
An Oscar nomination?
But I do think a sort of an underrated part about 10 Cloverfield Lane is like, you know, the conceit of it is like you're in this like tiny confined space. Like it's
yeah,
a really,
it's really
good example of like tense filmmaking using these like little, you know, you're stuck in an underground bunker kind of.
Yeah, and when it gets out the acid bucket, the way Trachtenberg is able to sort of handle the tension in that scene is just...
That scene is, like, one of the most upsetting scenes I've ever seen in a movie. It's so good. But, so, and then what makes Prey so interesting is it's, like, the opposite of that. It's this huge, gorgeous movie with these, like, beautiful forest locations. Just, like,
sure.
Large-scale action. It's great. It looks great. It's... The performances are good. It's, like, a really good Predator movie. You know, it's just like there's so many scenes in it that are just really, really fun and impressive.
Yeah.
I think it's my favorite Predator movie, definitely since the first one.
How many Predator movies have you seen?
I've seen them all except the other most recent one. I didn't see the Shane Black, like, whatever that one was called. The Predator.
That's the only one. So I haven't seen all of Predator 2. I remember seeing parts of it. I don't think I've seen the whole thing.
Yeah, I can't guarantee that I've seen all of Predator 2 either.
Yeah.
I've definitely watched it on TV, and I've like seen most of it. It's fine. The Predator's in Los Angeles, and Danny Glover's there. Like, it's fine.
The Danny Glover part is like, just watch those parts, and
yeah, exactly.
It's fun to see it in LA.
Yeah.
But Predator 1 is one of my personal favorite.
Predator 1
like,
is great.
Movies.
I like Predators. The one that has
guess
like,
who also likes Predators?
Who?
This
you?
Guy.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. We saw
it's pretty
in,
fun.
We saw that in theaters, and like it was a great time in the theater.
That was one of the first R-rated movies I saw in theaters.
Yeah, I saw it in law school. I think that movie is super fun. But yeah, Prey is very, very good. Yeah, if you like those other ones, I think you'll really, really enjoy it.
Yeah.
So
I'm really excited for Prey.
Yeah. What have you been watching?
This week, well, God, I really need to get on my 2022 watches.
You do, because we have to do our check-in this month. Like, it's not even a mid-year check-in at this point. It's just a pre-fall movie season. We can talk about...
Which, that's the time period we did it last year, which is like There's no real season for the first 3 months of the year.
Yeah.
Then there's 3 months of, you know.
Yeah, and then we'll get into award, like, fall award season stuff. So, yeah, so you got a handful to catch up on for that.
So I binged 4 of the 5 Archers movies I wanted to get to. I still didn't get to Tales of Hoffman. Mm-hmm. But that's mainly because you could only watch it on DVD, and a lot of the time I didn't really have the DVD around, and it was hard to get it on. But all the other ones I was able to stream. Yeah. So I watched The Small Back Room, which is basically The Hurt Locker, done by the Archers in the late 40s. Mm-hmm. It's about sort of this spy guy, played by David Farrar. I don't know if you know David Farrar? Not really. He's in a lot of Archer's movies, though. He's the main guy. He's sort of like the sex appeal in Black Narcissus that gets all the nuns horny.
Okay, sure.
He's also one of the... There's this really great Archer's movie called Gone to Earth, where Jennifer Jones is like a wild girl who lives with the foxes and has to choose between two guys that like her.
Okay.
One's sort of like I think he's a priest or a school teacher. He's kind of like the good guy, but a bit of a wet blanket, honestly.
Okay.
And the other guy is like a hunter of foxes, and he's like mean and he's rough, but he's sexy. And that's who Farrar plays in that movie too. He's generally like the rough and sexy guy. So it was interesting going into The Small Back Room, and he plays like the most PTSD riddled like crybaby.
Oh, fair enough.
Which makes a lot of sense. Like that's nothing against him, but it's just like so opposite from the other two roles he had in Archer's movies.
Mm-hmm.
He's just completely shaken. His girlfriend is like desperately just trying to like keep him afloat. And the premise of this movie is there's these like thermos looking things that keep showing up around England that the Nazis are dropping.
Okay.
Which don't look like bombs at all. They're just like thermoses. And so people pick them up and get blown up.
Okay.
And so he's slowly trying to figure out where are they getting dropped? What's the way to disarm them? So, mm-hmm. so blah, blah, blah. It's awesome. Great movie. I watched a movie called Oh Rosalinda. Space Rosalinda
!
Which is based on let me see who did. It's based on an opera.
Okay.
They actually would later do Tales of Hoffman and Bluebeard's Castle as like literal opera adaptations. But this is like making an American musical based on this opera. Basically, there's this guy in post-war... where is Vienna?
Austria.
Mm-hmm. He's in post-war Austria. He's sort of like this Austrian guy. He's played by Anton Wahlbrook, who is the main guy in Red Shoes, and he's the German in The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. And basically, he gets dumped on this famous Russian statue by this Russian commander, czar guy that's important, as like a practical joke after a night of drinking. And everyone's mad at him, and so he's like, I'm gonna get you back. And Rosalind is like this hot girl that's married to this other guy. There's a main guy who's an Austrian, there's a Russian, American, and a French guy. And it's all these different people like messing with each other, and Rosalind is going in between each other, and so colorful. It's hilarious. It's a blast of a movie. Outside of Black Narcissus, I think that'd be the most Archer's movie. I think
sounds interesting.
Then I watched The Edge of the World, which Nick told me was bad, and I think he's done.
I think he said it's okay. I don't think he said it's bad. He said it's okay.
I think this is probably the most, at least in the black and white movies, it's probably the most beautiful one. There's so many. Do you know the idea behind this movie?
No.
So it's kind of a docufiction movie. There's this island off of Scotland, which these people sort of lived in. But basically they had to evacuate because like just the soil wasn't growing. The way of life couldn't be kept up. And it's basically
they should have built a wicker man.
Okay, that could be another way that it could work.
Right.
Can we not build Wicker Man?
That's why they built the Wicker Man, and the Wicker Man is because the soil wasn't, they were on a little island and the soil wasn't growing anything anymore. So
can we not build a Wicker Man?
Okay, sorry. What do they do instead? They choose not to build a Wicker Man. What do they do?
They leave.
That's it. Well, all right.
But it's sort of like there's these wide shots of like vistas, natural landscapes. There's these beautiful moments where there's these people that like come to the island at the beginning and it's all abandoned. Like there's this double exposure of people walking past them like ghosts. It's really emotional, really melancholic. It's beautiful. And then lastly, I watched the very late Powell and Pressburger movie. This one came out in 1969.
Oh, wow.
It stars James Mason. Ooh. As an older artist who's sort of like this abstract guy and he can't like become inspired anymore. So he goes off to live on an island. And while he's there, he meets a underage Helen Mirren, who is always trying to show him her naked body.
Oh, you know. Helen Mirren, used to be in a lot of movies where she did that.
Yeah, and most of this movie is basically Lolita without sort of the gender age gap criticism.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's got a little bit, but like, what the fuck? Come on, Michael Powell. I don't think Pressburger was part of this. Yeah, no, it's just a Michael Powell movie, but it's a little uncomfortable. A little uncomfortable, this guy
mm-hmm.
painting her and slowly kind of growing a relationship. There's a really good dog in it.
Nice.
Watch for the dog. Oh,
there's a really good dog in Prey also. So
does it die?
No, dog's fine.
Okay.
Dog's fine.
I would genuinely...
No, I wouldn't have. I would not have been like, there's a good dog in the movie or something like that. Come on now.
So, and the last thing I guess I have to report is this technically isn't a movie, but the Christmas specials are on Letterboxd. I finished Downton Abbey.
Oh, wow. All the way to the bitter end?
All the way to the bitter end.
And did you watch both movies too?
We're going to watch them later, but okay. All the Christmas specials are like an hour and a half and are considered TV movies. And so...
When Dan Stevens opted out, I too opted out of Downton Abbey. So
gotta say, you could feel his loss.
Truly, and like shout to a guy who I think was like, I am over this, and I can make movies, and I think he made a good choice.
That's sort of what was on my plate.
All right,
what are we talking about next?
Do you want to, how much time do you think you need before summer or before catch up?
Let's see what I need to watch.
I have two movies to watch, so I can.
Okay, great. That's so much more than I have to watch. Where is my catch up list?
Oh, hold on. No. That's not it.
What the heck?
Yeah, you have too many lists on your letterbox. It's literally impossible to navigate, so.
Oh, I know.
Because every once in a while, I'll try to go look for something, and I'm like, nope, not going to find it. Oh, well.
I think I need 7 movies.
Out of 9 you've seen? So, literally, that can't be true, because we made a list of 9 movies. I have 2 left to watch, which I guess means those are the 2 you've seen, and you have the other 7 left to watch. Is that accurate?
We've both seen Nope.
We've both seen Nope. Okay, so maybe you only...
And I've seen Turning Red.
Oh, you haven't seen RRR.
No.
Okay, got you. So I have Turning Red and RRR to watch. I've seen everything else on our list.
I need to see Ambulance, Batman, Currents of the Future, Everything Everywhere All at Once, Kimmy, RRR, Top Gun, Maverick.
2 of those movies are a full 3 hours
three
long.
3 hours long.
And some of the rest of them are like 2.5. So, although some of them are like 80, so you know.
You just say 2 weeks?
Sure, let's say 2 weeks. Nick just wanted to know if we were talking Pasolini. Which,
tell Nick we didn't.
Nick,
see this
I
thing.
Did. I said I haven't seen the Pasolini film. That is the extent of our discussion.
Yeah.
We should wrap up. We are we're rambling, but so we're gonna do a catch up in 2 weeks. And we'll find something else to talk about before then. It's
going
to be
sure
a weird schedule for the next couple of months. We've got a lot going on. But
I think Viva Savi will come out after this episode, especially because this episode was very short.
Yeah.
So it'll be this. It'll be Viva Savi. And then, and maybe we'll see. We'll see what we can do this upcoming weekend.
But yeah, you got some movies to watch. Start watching them.
They will start this weekend now that I can
Okay.
get done with my Archer's marathon.
All right, sounds good. All right, well, thanks Scott for our podcast artwork, art
What a
by Scott
king.
92 on Instagram with the underscores in the middle. And we'll be back talking about something sometime soon.
Sounds good.
All right.
Roger out.
Roger out. Do-do.